Deserts and streams, the rise of Dos Cabezas, and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the March 2024 issue. We'll start out today with the editor's letter by Robert Steve. I'm not familiar with the scent of a pale evening primrose. I've hiked past them in the Grand Canyon and probably at Pinta Sands and Cabeza Prieta, but I've never knelt down to breathe in their scent. Expedition has always gotten in the way. Go, go, go. And so has the nature of the flower. Like lounge singers and cat burglars, evening primroses only come out at night. They'll wait until the world's tucked in and the sky's one ceaseless shimmer, Rita Dove wrote in her beautiful poem about the flower, then lift their saturated eyelids and blaze, blaze all night long for no one. It's an evolved strategy to lure in hawk moths, bats, and other nighttime pollinators. But if you don't have wings and nocturnal tendencies, you have to work a little harder to see their bloom and smell their scent. I haven't done the work. It's always go, go, go. So I asked Wendy Hodson. She's a senior research botanist at Desert Botanical Garden in Phoenix. She says the scent of a pale evening primrose is incredibly sweet, a floral aroma that rivals any perfume you'd find at Bergdorf Goodman. It's one of her favorite flowers. She's fond of birdcage evening primrose, too. It's another night owl with a sweet fragrance. March is a month when we celebrate the emergence of wildflowers in the Sonoran Desert. Like monarch butterflies returning to Pismo Beach in the winter, the flowers show up every spring and put on a show. Gold poppies, gold mallows, hyacinths, lupines, owl's clover, verbenas, cream cups, primroses, they're radiant dancers in a chorus line orchestrated by Mother Nature. It's enough to make even the most hardened antagonists acknowledge the undeniable beauty of our desert, especially in the spring. It's a season that laughs at definitions, Joyce Rockwood Munch wrote in our March 1960 issue, and lays out horizons that defy painter, photographer, or writer, as perhaps no other kind of landscape can. All over the desert, where countless unnoticed little dry washes stand ready for summer rain runoffs, spring flows in casual rivers of color. Poppies seem to favor them particularly, with an occasional shift of emphasis when white-petaled evening primroses nudge their yellow neighbors. A year ago, those rivers were raging with wildflowers, because 6 months earlier, their seeds germinated at exactly the right time, the rains came repeatedly in precise amounts, and the desert was endowed with a superbloom. Like a supernova, a superbloom is a rare and mighty explosion, one that comes around every 10 years or so and covers the landscape with an array of color, as if Monet had gone on a bender. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, it reinforces your belief in God or Mother Nature or some combination of the two. There's a feeling you get when you walk through the giant forest in the Sierra Nevada. Nothing on earth can prepare you for the scale of a sequoia. It brings a feeling of reverential respect and wonder. There's a surreal nature to it, too, like walking through one of Grimm's fairy tales. The superbloom prompts a similar sensation. It doesn't seem real. This year, there won't be a superbloom, but spring is about more than just the wildflowers. It's a time when darkness gives way to light, a time of hope, rebirth, and renewal. It's also a time to savor the wonders of nature. As spring enters upon the scene, Raymond Carlson wrote, we can woo her in all her moods, merry or melancholy, across the broad, rich land. We can play truant from care and raise our eyes to the far horizons and the tantalizing vistas of earth and sky wrapped in spring's flossiest lace. We can seek anew the beauty of the smiling land, for there is magic and sorcery in her invitation to each and all of us. The Japanese embrace something known as Shinrin Yoku, which means forest bathing or taking in the forest atmosphere. It caught on about 40 years ago as a way of getting people off the couch and into the woods, but the notion wasn't new. Everybody needs beauty as well as bread, John Muir wrote in 1912. places to play in and pray in, where nature may heal and give strength to body and soul alike. And before Mr. Muir, almost every culture recognized the powerful correlation between the natural world and human health. Although Shinrin Yoku is focused on the forest, a walk among the wildflowers can have the same effect. It's the same way that you can inhale the scent of a tree, you can inhale the scent of a flower, maybe more so. And there will be flowers this spring, even in an off year, but they won't be around for long, so you need to find your way to the desert, to the Superstition Mountains, Picacho Peak, Salt River Canyon, the Ironwood Forest, Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, and when you get there, be sure to stop, kneel, and breathe in the scent of the wildflowers. It's okay to slow down for a few hours. If you will, I will. And this concludes Editor's Letter. The next article is entitled, Springtime in the Desert, an essay by Ruth Rudner. Spring is the beginning of time. I know this because my brother and I and our two cousins were all born in the spring. I also know it because spring marks the beginning of the year for the Tohono O'odham people. While gorgeous white blossoms appear on the sororal tops and at the ends of their arms in late April and May, it is a time of fruiting in early June that begins the year. June may be late spring in the Gregorian calendar, but it is spring nonetheless. Sororals are hardly the only indicator of spring in the vastness and variety of the Sonoran Desert, but they are the only plant with which I've fallen in love. These are cactuses demanding a relationship. They are so vividly connected, I find it hard not to see them as people. Standing in groups of two or three, they are obviously spending their time talking to one another, their language emphasized by arm gestures, by their postures in relation to one another. I've not heard their voices, but there is no question they are speaking. I tried to convince my photographer husband to do a book with me about their conversations. He seemed to think I didn't really understand landscape photography. Only recently have I learned that the Tohono O'odhams, the people who have always lived among them, call them kin. Although the Sonoran Desert is a country of sororals, their only country in fact, the cactuses have become symbolic of the American West everywhere in the world, as easily recognized by the Mongolian yak herder as by the Milanese fashion designer. Presented a picture of a sororo, either is apt to say, in delight and in English, cowboy. Sororals exemplify patience. In no rush to do things, they grow about 1 to 1.5 inches in their first 8 years. Protected by nurse trees from too much desert sun in their early years, they ultimately reach heights of 40 feet or taller. Outgrowing the need for the nurse tree's shade, they rob the tree of water, causing its demise. About 35 years old before they begin producing flowers, they require 50 to 70 years, or sometimes a century, for arms to appear. At age 125, they're considered adults. Fully hydrated sororals weigh between 3,200 and 4,800 pounds, about half the weight of a female elephant. This observation may not be a particularly relevant fact about the Sonoran Desert. Their usual lifespan is 150 to 175 years, although biologists believe some plants might live more than 200 years. In any case, they outlive us. So when these guys stand around talking in the desert, they have the wisdom of years. Deserts, I think, teach time. They give the earth space to breathe, an opening of the earth to sky, a pause between forests and oceans, an experiment in ways to live. In the biodiverse Sonoran Desert, the wettest desert in North America, all the usual spring events are extant. Trees bud, wildflowers bloom, wildlife is born. There is a change in how the sun acts, how the planet turns, how the earth dances. This is true everywhere, desert or deepest forest, Arctic Circle or equator. But only in the Sonoran Desert do sororals, those most human of plants, grow. The Sonoran covers 120,000 square miles of Arizona, California, and Mexico. Most of Arizona's portion is in the southern third of the state, and it includes Phoenix and Tucson. The region in south-central Arizona and northern Sonora, Mexico, the highest and coldest section, can experience hard winter frost. The Sonoran Desert includes nearly all of Earth's biomes, from palm trees in the Kofa Mountains, those are California fan palms thought to be remnants of some long-ago ice age, to ponderosa pines, Douglas firs, and sometimes snow on 9,130-foot Mount Lemmon, which boasts the southernmost ski area in the continental United States. The ironwood, a common nurse tree for saguaros, along with Palo Verdes and mesquites, is a singular tree, with geographical limits essentially matching the Sonoran Desert's boundaries. It seems made to be a companion to saguaros. It also is quite beautiful in its lavender or purple blooms, which it produces on a schedule all its own. Possessing one of the world's heaviest woods, it is resistant to rotting, making it essentially non-biodegradable. Spring possesses urgency. In the way mountain water rushes down deep canyons, a surging, lithic run into this new season in the sounds of birdsong, of nesting birds or resting birds headed north to nest. More than 350 bird species live in or pass through the Sonoran Desert. For birders, spring here might be a near equivalent of nirvana. In March and April of a good spring, poppies cover hillsides and the spaces between the hills, and globe mallows, gilias, hyacinths, marigolds, lupines, owl's clover, desert lavender, and brittle bushes paint a desert canvas to fill any plein air artist with joy. In such a miracle of spring, photographers are almost as ubiquitous as poppies. Earth laughs in flowers, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote. He wasn't writing about the desert, but the context of any writer's words is irrelevant in the face of their truth. Few places on earth are so giddily joyous as a desert landscape in its time of flowering. If the monsoon rains come, if a wet winter follows, if everything necessary for the desert's moisture happens, this kind of display will occur, although even in the best of times, such a spectacle might take place only once a decade. Absent that, good wildflower displays can still happen in localized areas. Deserts develop in arid climates. Desert plants, like desert animals, have evolved to survive in this aridity in normal times of drought. Drought itself is part of how the earth works. A warming climate is a different story, and the Sonoran Desert is as subject to the effects of climate change as the rest of the natural world. According to defenders of wildlife, precipitation here has dropped by 25% to 40% over the past 50 years, the average temperature having risen by about 1.5 degrees since the mid-20th century, is poised to rise more. Rising temperatures play havoc with spring, not to mention the rest of life. My first experience of the Sonoran Desert occurred one spring years ago at Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument. It was one of the good years for flowers, with poppies spreading across the desert floor to Mount Ajo. As a northerner, this was my introduction to cactuses, the first organ pipes and tororos and ocotillos I'd ever seen, and the first teddy bear cholla's. I found their name, Cylindropuntia bigelovii, perfect. Big love, it seemed to mean. How could one not have big love for so cuddly-looking a plant? I did change my mind after discovering, thank heavens, not personally, that this teddy bear's spines are barbed. Getting too near the plant is not unlike the experience of having one's dog roll on a dead porcupine. Nearly 300 bird species have been recorded at Organ Pipe, but the monument is home to just one fish species, the endangered Quitobaquito pupfish, which in the U.S. lives in the wild only at Quitobaquito Springs, a small reservoir along the border. Also found there are the Sonoida mud turtle, the pepper grain-sized Quitobaquito spring snail, and the desert caper plant. A real oasis, Quitobaquito was used by the Odom people for thousands of years, then by settlers to the region. But signs of its past use were removed once Organ Pipe was designated a national monument. When I visited, the beauty of the pond, the colors and movement, and a kind of time radically different from that of the desert surrounding, it seemed a geography of magic. Never mind that trucks roared by on Mexico's Highway 2, a few hundred feet south of Quitobaquito. At the time, they seemed irrelevant, other than as a way to see how close I was to Mexico. For me, the border meant an artificial split in land rightfully belonging to the Tohono O'odhams. El Pinacante y Gran Desierto de Alta, like Organ Pipe, a UNESCO International Biosphere Reserve, lies on the Mexican side of the road, the two wild areas constituting a landscape that is really one piece. During my visit, the border wall did not yet exist. In writing this, I am aware of how much of the Sonoran Desert spring I've skipped. The Sonoran pronghorn, an endangered subspecies of the fastest land animal in North America, its speed possibly acquired to outrun the long extinct American cheetah, the desert tortoise, which lives for 50 years or longer, much of it underground, and for which spring is a prime foraging season, and the marvelous little elf owls perching in sororal cavities. All are vital to this ecosystem at this time of year, but there are four other seasons in the Sonoran Desert, according to many scientists. For summer, summer, fall, and winter. Maybe I can write about animals in autumn. And this concludes Springtime in the Desert. The next article is entitled Down on the Farm. Hayden and Hannah Barnard know all about riding horses, raising cattle, fresh-cut alfalfa, leafhoppers, corn choppers, and silage. They're a couple of farm kids in southeastern Arizona, and they wouldn't have it any other way. Edited by Kelly Vaughn, photographs by Scott Baxter. White barn hay and cattle near Portal rests in the cradle of the San Simon Valley, the 65-mile-long swath of land that separates the Chiricahua, Dos Cabezas, and Pinalino Mountains on its western edge from the Peloncillo Mountains on its east side. There, Candace and Jason Barnard raise cattle, including Wagyu beef, and grow corn and other crops. They also homeschool their three children, daughters Hayden and Hannah, and son Ethan, and 10 livestock guardian dogs, horses, show lambs, and chickens. It's a traditional way of life for the Barnards, who both come from families with long farming and ranching legacies. Noel and Anna Curry settled in McNeil in 1952. The next year, Ernie and Eunice White moved from California and homesteaded just up the road in the middle of a mesquite grove near Elfrida. The families became close friends, helping each other over the countless hurdles that emerge on the road to establishing crops and effectively working challenging land. Jason, the Curry's grandson, studied agronomy at Texas A&M University, while Candace, the White's granddaughter, studied animal science at the University of Arizona. The couple met in Cochise in 2002 and married in 2004, joining the two families. Now, the Barnard's children are learning the family business, helping with feeding animals, working the crops, and so much more. Here, Aiden, 13, and Hannah, 12, share their thoughts about living and working at White Barn. What do you like about living on the farm? Hayden, my absolute favorite thing about living on the farm is the spectacular view of the mountains and the valley from our living room window. I love seeing my horses every day and picking fresh alfalfa for them. I also enjoy farm talks with my parents when we talk about animal health care and the growing conditions on the farm. Hannah, I love to smell the fresh cut alfalfa as I run by the fields on my horse. It is also very fun to play with my lambs on the cotton mounds and piles of corn. Picking fresh corn from the field is amazing. Sometimes my dad and I find the best ear of corn to eat, and it's always sweet, crisp, and tasty. What are some of the challenges of farm life, and how do you handle them? Hayden, some farm talk sessions are about the challenges of farming. Diseases in crops can be a big challenge. This year we grew corn that became infested with leafhoppers, green bugs that hop from corn leaf, eating sap from the leaves and transferring a virus into the plant. The virus stresses the plant and decreases the yield. The yield is very important to our family feedlot. We feed the corn we grow to the cattle that come to our feed yard. A lower yield means a higher cost in corn production and that we have to buy corn from other local corn producers. Hannah, drought is one of our biggest challenges on the farm and ranch. With no rain, we have to move the cattle into the higher pastures where there's a little more feed. When the feed runs out, we will have to make some tough management decisions because without rain, the grass won't last long. Little rainfall can be both good and bad for our crops. This year, we harvested 7 cuts of alfalfa and had no rained on hay. The bad part about no rain is that we had no help to water the crops and the water bill gets really expensive. Talk about the animals on the farm. Hayden, we have many animals on the farm. We definitely have a lot of cattle. We also have chickens, livestock, guardian dogs, a lot of horses, and occasionally some show lambs. Hannah, we have many animals here on our farm and ranch. We have cattle, show lambs, chickens, horses, dogs, and cats. There is always some kind of animal noise through all parts of the day and night. Can the heavy equipment be intimidating or is it kind of cool? Hayden, as I get older, working with heavy equipment gets more and more fun. From the ages of 3 to 5, riding on the tractor or playing with tractor tire rims was more fun than playing mud pie factory in our playhouse. One time when I was about 6, my daddy took my sister and me with him on the swather to start cutting alfalfa. Inside, there were lots of tiny alfalfa spiders. I absolutely dislike spiders of any size, so I freaked out, screaming, crying, the whole tantrum of being afraid of little spiders. Daddy let me drive with him because there weren't a great deal of spiders on the driver's side. As we were turning around to start cutting another section, I turned the swather steering wheel a little too vigorously, and the swather spun around and around really fast. My sister and I thought it was the best ride in the whole world, but not so much my daddy, so I didn't get to drive anymore. At age 13, I enjoy driving the tractors, but I am still scared of the alfalfa spiders in the swather. When I'm around heavy equipment, I have to be very careful so I don't get hurt. Hannah, when I wake up in the morning, there's always something rumbling around. Equipment is one of the most popular things you will see around here. We have tractors, balers, feed wagons, and lots more. One of my favorite things about fall is when the corn chopper comes and chops the corn. It has lots of razor-sharp blades used to grind the corn and turn it into silage. Every morning, Loopy scoops up feed with the loader and puts it into the feed mixer wagon. Then he drives by the feed bunks and the mixer pours out pounds of feed for the cattle. The ranch always smells like fresh hay in the mornings. What is it like to work at some of the markets where you sell your beef? Hayden, I love going to farmers markets to sell beef. I like to answer people's questions and talk about our beef genetics. The hardest part of the market is getting everything ready. We have to clean the beef wagon, then pack all the cuts of beef, and make sure we have all the selling supplies, such as the cash box, the table, the price sheet, and other important things. After we get everything packed, we wash the beef wagon so it looks nice and flashy. The second hardest part is driving to the market. We live far from town, and it takes several hours of driving. When we get there, we have to hurry and set up because people are waiting for us to arrive. My siblings and I then set up quickly while our mom and dad talk to customers. It's always fun to set up signs and arrange the table with price sheets and pictures of the cattle. Hannah, going to farmers markets is a great experience. I learn a lot about being a great saleswoman and how to communicate about what happens on our farm. But my favorite thing about the farmers market is shopping. I love to support the other vendors who are selling. In fact, I become so regular that when I walk around, the vendors know me by name. The farmers market is the place to go to have fun. Growing up on a farm and ranch takes farm fresh to a whole new level. What are some of your favorite meals that center on the food you've grown? Hayden, my all-around favorite food is black bean and pumpkin chili. I would be okay if my mom made this once a week for the rest of my life. Smoked brisket is another of my favorites. That's always a special treat. Hannah, I have a lot of favorite recipes, so this question is hard, but somehow I managed to narrow it down to 3. I love chicken fried steak and mashed potatoes, enchiladas and rice, and black bean and pumpkin chili. These are my favorite foods to eat for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and leftovers. And this concludes Down on the Farm. The next article is entitled Mayhew's Oak Creek Lodge. Grand Canyon Lodge has the best view in Arizona, but another lodge in another canyon might have been a close second. Sadly, it burned to the ground in 1980. Articles written by Kathy Montgomery. In 1926, Carl Mayhew was newly in love. No doubt, he still loved his wife of 14 years, and Ethel had no cause for jealousy. Because Carl was not infatuated with another woman, he was smitten with the lodge he had recently purchased in Oak Creek Canyon. This wonderful place, he wrote, like a great sunken garden of orchards, roses, and vine-covered buildings, is located at the bottom of the canyon, a canyon of mystery with its great buff walls of sandstone eroded into fantastic shapes, silhouetted against the glorious Arizona sky. Ethel likely felt less enchanted. On the couple's first visit to the canyon, their Ford Model A had to be pushed out while Ethel carried their young daughter up the steep grade. She vowed never to return. Years later, Ethel recalled that when they bought the lodge, there were weeds as high as your head and pigs were running wild. But under her care, the lodge became renowned for its orchards, its prize-winning dahlias, and especially Ethel's cooking. Back then, the canyon was remote and difficult to reach, which was why legendary hunter Bear Howard built a cabin there after his escape from a California jail around 1880. No doubt the romance of the tale added to the allure of the place, as Carl incorporated both the story and Howard's cabin into his newly christened Mayhew's Oak Creek Lodge. A photographer of some repute, Carl was a relative newcomer to Arizona. Having arrived in Flagstaff in 1922, he fell in love with the canyon after Jesse Lasky, co-founder of what would become Paramount Pictures, hired him to help with a silent film he was producing based on a Zane Grey novel. Released in 1923, The Call of the Canyon set the Mayhew family, as well as Sedona, on a new course, expanding on what his predecessors, the Thomas family, had built after buying Howard's cabin and homesteading the land. Carl decorated the lodge with photos he had made in Paris during World War I, an ancient cherry tree brushed against second-story windows, and a grapevine climbed through the floor, wandering through the lodge and out again. Given its origin story, it's not surprising that in its early days, the lodge hosted a constellation of Hollywood stars as bright as those in the sky above. After a day of fishing, croquet, or tennis, guests gathered for cocktails before wandering into the dining room overlooking the creek. Carl died in 1943, but the family kept the lodge running before selling it to the U.S. Forest Service in 1969. Left to deteriorate, it burned to the ground in 1980. A few stone ruins and fruit trees near the West Fork Oak Creek Trailhead remain as a curiosity to the multitudes who still heed the canyon's call. And this concludes Mayhew's Oak Creek Lodge. Next up, Damselfly by Kelly Vaughan. Although damselflies are commonly mistaken for dragonflies, these insects are smaller and slimmer. Most damselfly species, including the common bluetail, Ichnora heterostigta, fold their wings along their bodies while at rest. In contrast, dragonflies hold their wings flat and away from their bodies. Damselflies can be found on every continent except Antarctica, and in Arizona, you'll find them near streams, ponds, rivers, and lakes, where these predators hunt other, tinier insect species. To learn about Arizona's animals, pick up copies of our wildlife-themed books. Arizona Wildlife by Bruce D. Talbert offers stunning images of the state's native species, while the Arizona Highways Wildlife Guide by Brooke Bessenson features 125 of Arizona's most frequently viewed mammals, reptiles, birds, amphibians, and fish. To order online, visit shoparizonahighways.com/books. This concludes today's readings from the March 2024 issue of Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Deserts and streams, the rise of Dos Cabezas, and the outlaws I see in my dreams.